This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Something's changed in the language of our politicians, according to my guest Michael Kazin. He says the vocabulary of grassroots rebellion that was once used by the left is now used by the right. The rhetoric, once spoken primarily by reformers and radicals, has been creatively altered by conservative politicians and religious groups. Kazin's new book, The Populist Persuasion, is a history of how populism has migrated from the left to the right. Kazin is a professor of history at American University. He's the son of writer Alfred Kazin. Michael Kazin says that in the early days of populism, back in the late 1800s, farmers organized against an economic elite of big bankers, merchants, railroads, and the politicians who defended them. Now, Kazin says, conservatives are using populist language to organize against government bureaucrats and the cultural elite. I ask Kazin what the significance is in the shift of populist language.
Because populism is, I think, the primary language, has been historically, with which Americans, especially white Americans, speak their discontent with power. It means that the whole idea that there's a grassroots uprising is now an idea which is located on the right. The idea that the grassroots uprising is on the right, whether people listen to Rush Limbaugh or support the Republican Party or support the Christian Coalition. The idea now is that the people, with a capital P, are on the right, the minority, the, if you will, even undemocratic minority, is on the left. And that's a big change. And it's very important in America, in a democratic country like ours, for any political force to claim the ordinary people for itself.
Well, who were the first populists against? Who did they see as the power that they opposed?
It was an economic elite. It was the railroads. It was the bankers. It was the commodities markets. It was people who were making money off those who really produced wealth, farmers and workers.
And now who is the power seen as being?
Much more, I think, being bureaucrats in Washington and being this rather ambiguously defined, but nevertheless quite powerful, cultural elite, which supposedly runs the major TV networks and New York Times, Washington Post, some of the major news magazines as well.
Is the idea of a cultural elite a fairly new concept in American politics?
Not really. The original populists in the 1890s, the People's Party, were very opposed to the cultural elite, but they saw this cultural elite as combined with an economic one. That is, they saw the people who had the most money in America also as being amoral and having secular values and drinking too much alcohol and living a high life. But they fused the two critiques, the critique of economic power and the critique of cultural power, whereas now those two critiques tend to be more separated.
You consider George Wallace to be one of the people who took the language of populism and started using it for the right, and in fact using it as an argument for segregation. Can you talk a little bit about George Wallace's place in this shift?
Sure. Well, George Wallace, of course, is a Democrat and was a New Dealer in his youth and came from a part of the Democratic Party in the South that was really left-wing populist. It was supportive of labor movements, supportive of, in fact, even of white and black cooperation in a limited way. But Wallace soon learned that in the 1950s, as the civil rights movement began and as resistance against that movement grew, that he wasn't going to get elected governor if he continued to talk about interracial cooperation and continued to support the liberal side of the Democratic Party, which was very unpopular in his region. So he began to attack the civil rights movement, but more importantly, he began to attack white elites in Washington and elsewhere who were supportive of the civil rights movement. He attacks the desegregation plans of Washington elitists who are sending their kids to private schools but want to force white children to go to school with black children, even if they have to take buses to go across town. And also, Wallace, most importantly perhaps, drew an interesting kind of class line across American politics. He identified himself as a working man, and in fact was probably the first presidential candidate in the 20th century to identify himself as such, except for a few socialists. And he was able to get a lot of support from people, working class white people, who had been dyed-in-the-wool Democrats ever since the 1930s. So he begins to break down the liberal coalition and really begins to claim the core of the populist language of the left for the right.
Have you been following Newt Gingrich carefully and analyzing the language that he's using?
I don't think Newt Gingrich uses the language of populism quite as much as some other figures on the right. I think Gingrich's main passions are libertarian passions. He really wants to free up entrepreneurial energies. He, as you know, looks toward the future, the so-called third wave future. And he, I don't think, is as connected to the concerns and the language of the Christian right or of those who still think their taxes are being stolen by the liberal elite, as some other figures on the right are. I think Gingrich's great achievement is to talk about all the things that the government is doing wrong. And in that sense, of course, he sometimes uses terms like the liberal elite and the government establishment and stupid bureaucrats and so forth. But I think Gingrich is an interesting figure because he, I think, would like to get away from some of the elite bashing that Republicans have done successfully in the last 20, 25 years, but he doesn't want to do it completely because, after all, that's been very successful. On the other hand, he himself is a historian. He understands some of the pitfalls of using populist language because, after all, if you become the establishment, people start coming after you.
Let's look at the Christian right. What about the language it's using?
Well, the Christian Coalition, which is, of course, the major force on the Christian right these days, really uses a language which is quite old in its provenance. Ralph Reed, the leading figure, along with Pat Robertson in the Christian Coalition, in fact, often harks back to the Prohibition movement and talks about how the God-fearing majority is that its values are being undermined subtly and sometimes not so subtly by school teachers who teach sex education, by relativistic ideas of morals in various parts of people's schooling, and also, of course, in the media. And really what the Christian Coalition is saying is that if you left families, hardworking, God-fearing families alone, and didn't tell them what to believe, things would be fine. But there are this meddlesome group of social engineers which always wants to make people different and pull them away from the values with which they've been born.
You write about how the New Democrats tried to use the language of populism, particularly President Clinton during his campaign. Can you give some examples of that?
Well, sure. Well, first of all, the famous slogan, putting people first, mm-hmm. talk about the middle class squeeze, the kinds of decline of income of middle class people, jobs going overseas, that kind of thing. The Clinton campaign in 92, I think, was also quite successful at speaking to the so-called Reagan Democrats, who had been Democrats before, but had been voting Republican, talking to them in economic terms and trying to put the cultural issues aside as much as possible, trying to get away from talking about issues like abortion and crime and so forth, and putting the emphasis on the economic plight of a lot of people in the middle of the economy.
My guest is Michael Kazin. He's the author of a new book about how populism has migrated from the left to the right. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Kazin, author of the new book, The Populist Persuasion. Where do you see talk radio fitting in the political landscape now? And what does it say to you about public sentiment?
Well, the obvious, and many people have said it, is that talk radio allows people to vent their discontent on a regular basis and to talk to someone who will agree with the sources of the discontent that they identify and will encourage them to believe that mostly liberals and people in government are the source of it. I think, though, that it's sort of sad evidence for the decline of a kind of participatory populism. After all, being an audience, even being an active member of an audience, is not the same as being part of a movement. It's not the same as building a community of people who are trying to take on the powerful in one's community, in one state, or in the country. And I think there's a passivity, a new kind of angry passivity, if you will, among a lot of people listening to talk radio, where you can cheer a caller, you can boo a caller, you can cheer the host or boo the host, but it's not the same as doing the hard work of actually putting together organizations, associations to try to change things.
And yet the sentiments being expressed on a lot of talk programs, especially the more conservative ones, particularly ones with huge audiences like Rush Limbaugh's, are being credited with having swayed the election, this past election, toward the Republican win in Congress. So it's odd, on the one hand you're talking about how it's passivity being an audience, even being an active member of the audience. On the other hand, it's seen more as a voting bloc now, that audience. And in that respect, it has a lot of power.
Sure, but the number of voters in this election didn't go up very much, if at all, from the number of voters in the last midterm election. And I'm not really sure whether the kind of people who voted for the Republicans and liked talk radio would have voted Republican anyway, whether talk radio was there or not. Certainly, they were encouraged to vote Republican because of talk radio. But they weren't encouraged to do much else besides vote Republican and then sit back and cheer on the television and cheer as the Contract with America was passed. The Contract with America, unlike earlier platforms, was put together by politicians. It wasn't put together by grassroots movements, as, say, the People's Party platform was 100 years ago. I think that's a key difference. This is really a consumer movement in a way, more than a movement of active participants, of producers, if you will, who want to make changes in their own lives.
In looking at that shift of language, do you think that people who are more conservative or are on the right today are using any of the language that was developed by the new left in the 60s or by the civil rights movement in the 60s?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, Bob Dole, when the new session of Congress opened, said we're going to bring power to the people, which was a slogan which was coined by the Black Panther Party in the 1960s, whose politics is about as far from Bob Dole's as it's possible to get. And certainly their definition of the people is this white middle class, for the most part, God-fearing, hardworking, not wanting to pay too many taxes that we've been talking about. And there's also a lot of talk about rights. There's always been rights talk in American history, but in the last few years, talk of rights has been the rights of white men to jobs and rights that supposedly been taken away by black people, by women who are claiming affirmative action slots. Talk of the rights of property owners not to have their property regulated by the government, not to be told what kind of environmental regulations they have to obey. So talk of rights has also been appropriated to a certain degree by conservatives.
What do you see as being the strengths and the traps of populism?
Well, the strengths, I think, are obvious. That is, not so obvious. It's our language it's our American language of class. It's a way in which one can group together the industrious majority against those who are not so industrious. It's a language of democracy. It's a language of democracy betrayed and redeemed, if you will. The idea that the people would be in power if that power wasn't being taken away from them by an elite, and they can get power back again if they organize. That's, I think, many ways part of the founding ideals of America. The pitfalls are, first of all, that it's been a language which has been identified historically mostly with white Americans. And also, it's a language of blame. It's a language of resentment.
How is it a language of blame?
Well, instead of blaming, for instance, the desire by Americans for a easier, more sensual lifestyle, wanting more and better products all the time, for some of the amoralism which has crept into American culture, the Christian right, for instance, often blames people at the top who are pushing bad values on people, rather than looking at oneself and looking at one's family and looking at what really goes on in people's lives. I think there's a sense in which the enemy is always out there. The people are virtuous. The people are good. It's a kind of naive view, a romantic view of who the people are. And most individuals don't think of themselves as perfect and virtuous. But somehow, when one uses the language of populism, one is talking about the people as a whole being virtuous and moral. And I think that can lead us into a lot of troubles. We have to deal with who we are, with all our faults, and not blame some terrible establishment for trying to make us bad people.
Michael Kazin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Kazin is the author of The Populist Persuasion. He teaches at American University in Washington, D.C.